welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will join us again next week. On today's program, we're joined by the New York Times bestselling author David Talbot. He is also the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, a new partnership with Skyhorse Publications. And we are joined by two of the new Hot Books authors. First, we're joined by Nicholas Scow. He's author of Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. Later in the program, we'll be joined by Hot Books author Alexander Zaitchek. His book, The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. Join us on the Project Censored Show for an hour about Hot Books. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's program, we look at the best-selling author's latest project, David Talbot. We look at his project called Hot Books. It's a partnership with Skyhorse Publications. Of course, David Talbot is the New York Times best-selling author of The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. The book's called Brothers. His latest book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot joins us by phone to talk about Hot Books today. For the first part of the program, we're also joined by Hot Books author Nicholas Scow. His book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. So David Talbot and Nick Scow, welcome to the Project Censored Show. David Talbot, let's start with you. Tell us about Hot Books.
Hot Books I started a year ago with Tony Lyons of Skyhorse Publishing. And I come out of a magazine and newspaper background, and I felt that the news hole for serious, deep investigative journalism was quickly disappearing. And so books to me seemed to be one of the only formats left, at least in print journalism, where you could continue to do that kind of serious work. So I came up with an idea called Hot Books, an imprint dedicated to deep journalism, short format, about 40,000 words, about 120 pages or so, so people could read it pretty quickly and get the information they needed. And I went to some of the most provocative and, I thought, most hard-digging investigative journalists out there to start writing these books for me on the most burning topics. And I'm glad that you're featuring a couple of them today, Mickey.
Yeah, actually, David Talbot, we've certainly perused the list, and you've already had significant publications in this series, including American Nuremberg, The Gilded Rage, which we'll be talking about later on, another book on Snowden and so forth. So definitely something that people should check out, Hot Books. And right now we're also joined by Nick Scow, one of the authors on Hot Books. Nick, your book is Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. Given you have a background publishing on CIA and Gary Webb and so forth, it seems like a natural trajectory for you. Tell us about how you sat down and researched this book, Spooked, for David Talbot's Hot Books.
Well, the first thing that I did was read Carl Bernstein's 1977 Rolling Stone article in which he exposed decades of manipulation of the media by the CIA and named all the names of the different newspapers and editors and reporters that were in on this, and realized that really it had been since then, since this story had really been updated. I had some sort of direct experience, as you mentioned, in the 1990s when Gary Webb's story about CIA crack cocaine smuggling was criticized in the press and Gary's work was vilified. And recently, the CIA actually released new information about how it had worked with these media outlets to try to destroy his reputation. So I already had a little bit of a head start. But then I just decided to try to actually talk to as many national security reporters and retired CIA people, including folks like Frank Snapp, who was very helpful in trying to tell the other side of the story about how the CIA manipulates reporters. Because unlike previous times when the CIA directly employed papers and reporters, now they have to basically play reporters off each other and get reporters to do that work for free.
So it's pretty detailed and complex, this world that you're diving into here in this recent book regarding how the CIA manipulates media. And in fact, it's not just the news media that you delve into. And certainly at Project Censored, we look at news media censorship, both corporate media censorship, deep state type censorship. And also we've looked into Hollywood propaganda and propaganda as a form of censorship. So you talk about Hollywood as well. Can you talk about that?
What's interesting is that really since its inception, the CIA had a relationship with Hollywood where it had people working in the different studios that would try to guide films along certain political lines that the CIA wanted to see happen. And so By the 1970s, of course, this relationship had soured quite a bit during the Watergate era, during the Vietnam era. And so it really took until the Clinton era, the 1990s, for the CIA to kind of rehabilitate itself with Hollywood. And it created an office within its public affairs division that worked directly with Hollywood on trying to create scripts.
Entertainment liaison, actually, was one of the titles I recall seeing on the CIA's website.
Yeah, well, the first guy to do it was an officer named Chase Brandon. And so projects like Hunt for Red October and all the other Tom Clancy novels sort of built this relationship and created a string of box office successes that were also portraying the CIA in a much more favorable light than it occurred previously. So now this is pretty much an industry, like a revolving door type situation, where you have all these retired CIA people that kind of farm themselves out to Hollywood and also to increasingly to television, and they try to bring these Hollywood producers and directors and TV show directors and showrunners to Langley, where they meet with people in the CIA. And one of the funny interviews that I did for the book about this topic was with John Kiriakou, a whistleblower. He actually, when he was still with the agency, was talking about just bumping into people like Robert De Niro or Ben Affleck, just walking through the halls like they owned the place. They were given red carpet treatment.
And also Leon Panetta, a former head of the CIA who was just booed at the Democratic Convention for his involvement in the drone war campaign. You have an interesting story, too, Nick, about him in the book as well.
Yeah, well, he was very eager to have James Gandolfini portray him in Zero Dark Thirty and actually met with the stars and directors of that project. And, of course, Zero Dark Thirty is probably the most controversial outcome of this relationship between the CIA and Hollywood, where basically you had a narrative that the CIA wanted to spin to the public, sold via a film project. And despite controversy over how the film depicted torture, which I think in retrospect was a bit of a sideshow, the basic narrative of this cat and mouse game resulting in the assassination of Osama bin Laden was effectively sold to the public. And this wasn't something that Hollywood came up with. It was given to them by the CIA. And the CIA played a very, very serious role in trying to script that movie along those lines. And that's what everybody believes happened. But Seymour Hersh recently has poked a major hole in that, which the rest of the news media hasn't really effectively followed up on or countered, for that matter, to the extent that he suggested that longtime inside sources with the White House and with the intelligence community knew that bin Laden had been located by a Pakistani intelligence source that just told us where he was.
Again, that's pretty riveting kind of information, the detail and the extent to which the CIA is involved in these narratives. And you know, many of our historic narratives are not just born out of primary sources or out of the news, but they are born out of so-called entertainment, which seems to have an innocuous facade. But, you know, your chapter, Operation Tinseltown, in the book goes into some detail there. And we did mention a little bit about the Homeland series, the film Zero Dark Thirty. And then there was another one with Ben Affleck, Argo, right? And you have an interesting line in the book where you have a line from former CIA officer Robert Baer, who was talking about Argo and said, Argo had nothing to do with reality. Anybody involved in that operation knows that. What's your reaction to some of the things you discovered when you were researching this?
Bob Baer, you know, it's pretty funny. That guy was very frank about not just Argo, but also Zero Dark Thirty. I mean, he's another former intelligence source that I spoke with that didn't believe the official story about the bin Laden assassination. But with Argo, I mean, again, this is just like really an egregious case where it wasn't just the CIA being reflected as heroes in a Hollywood movie, but Hollywood got to be the hero of that movie as well. So it was kind of a win-win. And it was complete fiction, you know. So people, it's okay to be entertained, obviously, but when you get down to the real kind of nefarious aspect of this working relationship between the CIA and Hollywood, it has to do with providing kind of a veneer of authenticity. So people see shows, even shows like Homeland, for example, that they know are fictional, they still kind of create this perpetuating myth of the CIA as sort of guardians of our democracy. And despite all the outlandish things that agents like Kerry Matheson, for example, does, you know, the underlying message is we need people like her to do this to protect us from the greater danger of Islamic terrorism, for example. And it keeps the American public on this permanent footing of being afraid of everything.
A couple books ago in Censored 2014, Rob Williams wrote a chapter for us called Screening the Homeland, How Hollywood Fantasy Mediates State Fascism in the U.S. of Empire. And he starts it with an epigraph, one that you might recognize. It's from the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, who was beamed in via White House satellite to the Academy Awards in 2013. And said, quote, every day our children learn to open their imaginations, to dream just a little bigger. I want to thank all of you tonight for being part of that vitally important work. she's talking about Argo. Essentially, she's talking about the propaganda efforts of Hollywood.
Basically, the thrust of the chapter that I do is to try to alert the American public to this, because I think that the CIA has completely rehabilitated its relationship with Hollywood and expanded on it in a way that nobody really has focused on. And it's really important for people to realize that all these box office successful movies that are being sold to the public, it's not just entertainment, it's actually propaganda.
And it has real-world effect, and that's what I think spooked Nick Scow's book really drives home for people. And the real-life effects are that poll after poll of Americans show that there's wide support for the drone war, immoral, illegal air campaign against, in many cases, civilian populations with civilian casualties. There's wide American support among the public for torture. And now we have the Republican presidential candidate who's openly calling for an escalation of this torture and this carnage in the Middle East. And so Hollywood bears some responsibility, and the media as well, the news media, for laying the groundwork for that kind of public disinformation and public acclaim or support for these very dangerous policies.
Well, in fact, later in the program, David Talbot will be talking with Alexander Zaychek about The Gilded Rage, a book on Trump. So we'll certainly be addressing that later in the program. But David Talbot, let's continue with you for a moment. You wrote the foreword to Nick Scow's book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. And of course, you are no stranger to the roots of the CIA and the Deep State and the Dulles brothers and so forth. And you certainly are very well aware, as you write in the foreword, about the Rolling Stone article from Carl Bernstein, which Nick has already mentioned. And you're certainly aware of the revelations that come forward through the Pike Commission, the Church Committee, all these things in the 70s. But in your estimation, we heard Nick talking about how the CIA had rehabilitated its relationship since then. Could you talk to us a little bit historically, given your long background looking into the CIA and the deep state, and what do you think has changed in the way that the CIA operates in terms of public manipulation?
Well, it's more subtle, if anything, and Nick goes into how more pervasive in some ways it is and more subtle. In the old days, and look, this goes way back to the beginnings of the CIA in the late 1940s with Alan Dulles, the legendary spy master, and his head of counterintelligence, James Jesus Angleton. These guys were very sophisticated. They knew how important the media was. They knew how important Hollywood was to engage these forces in the culture war. And the culture war was not aimed solely at the Soviet Union and communism, but was aimed at promoting their own power within American democracy. And as Nick says, to give the American people a sense that you need a forceful agency like ours who may cut corners, who may undermine democratic principles or violate the Constitution from time to time, but we will protect you. And so this goes back to the beginning of the agency, where they, through various organizations funded, put enormous amounts of money into magazines, into films, into putting reporters and journalists on their payroll. And to them, this kind of propaganda war was really a front line in their battle. And that sensibility remains very much alive in Langley today. Nick talked about how there was a resurgence of their activity in Hollywood in the 90s. Well, I think it's tied directly to the fact that Oliver Stone's film, JFK, that explosive movie that, of course, pointed at the CIA as a prime suspect in the murder of President Kennedy, came out in 1991. And I think the CIA at that point said, this isn't going to happen again. We're not going to have movies like this.
And we actually interviewed Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, and Stone in particular, about the JFK issue on the 50th anniversary of the assassination. And within a couple of years after that film and the exposure of it, the Congress actually purportedly and allegedly said, well, it's time to have the documents come out. And they passed a provision that said that they were supposed to release the documents, and it hasn't happened still.
Well, thousands of documents were released under the JFK Record Collection Act, and in fact, I used many of those documents in my two books on this brothers about the Kennedy years, and my more recent book about Alan Dulles and the CIA, The Devil's Chessboard. So that was invaluable, and that shows you the power of Hollywood. One movie by Oliver Stone, JFK, had this enormous impact, forced Congress to force the CIA to release many, many of these records. But you're right.
Jefferson Morley, your colleague, is still struggling to get the rest released.
That's right. There's still over 1,500 documents that the CIA illegally, in violation of this law that was passed after Oliver's film came out, is still withholding. We feel that those are key documents that relate to many of the key suspects involved in the Kennedy assassination, men like William Harvey, who was head of the CIA's assassination unit at the time, and so on. The only thing that will get those records released, those final batch of records, is if there's another big big public outcry. And unfortunately, the only times that that happens is when you have a movie like Oliver's film JFK that hits a public nerve.
Indeed. We're speaking with David Talbot. He is New York Times bestselling author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, founder and editorial director of Hot Books, partner with Skyhorse Publications. We're also joined by investigative journalist Nick Scow. His recent book is Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. We'll continue our conversation with David Talbot and Nick Scow after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're featuring Hot Books by David Talbot. This is a partnership with Skyhorse Publications. It's a whole series of very significant books, really kind of old muckraking style journalism. The series of very important topics. We're going to talk with David Talbot here more about some of those books. We are also joined by one of the authors, Nick Scow. His book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood, is the topic for the first part of our show here today. And just before the break, we had mentioned JFK and Oliver Stone came up. And Oliver Stone says of Nick Scow's book, Spooked, Spooked is a concise and convincing essay on the nastiness of the CIA and the power it wields over American media, other government bodies, and in the end, our national perception. That's certainly what we've been talking about. And Nick Scow, let's go to you. Let's talk about another thing that relates to one of your earlier publications. It's hard really to ignore the role Gary Webb plays in the public mind in terms of not only the price that he paid for exposing the CIA and the crack cocaine importation and so forth, 80s, 90s, but also the fact that he was mercilessly attacked by the media that he worked in for so many years. Nick Scow.
As I write in my book, Kill the Messenger, there's never been a case like that before, where you had one reporter that was so mercilessly attacked by his colleagues and driven out of journalism ultimately. But I actually had a front row seat to this. And what I remember about Gary's story was that clearly it was incendiary and it was making some very, very powerful allegations about the CIA. And I believe that Gary felt and trusted that other reporters were going to join in the effort of trying to force the CIA to answer to this and to dig deeper. And so I actually was doing that. I was interviewing former CIA officials that were backing up Gary's reporting. But other reporters clearly went into this with the idea of trying to, as one LA Times editor put it, take away this guy's Pulitzer. I mean, the LA Times in particular was embarrassed by Gary's story. So you had the kind of craven motivation of the competitive press, which played right into the hands of the CIA. The CIA manipulated a press that was already eager to try to attack this guy's work because it hadn't done its job on that story. This was stuff that, I mean, anybody that was like sophisticated and around back in the 1980s had been reading stories like this for a long time, but no one had ever really gotten to the bottom of the puzzle of all these people working with the CIA and the drugs that we know were being smuggled into the country, like what specific impact it had. And when Webb put that story into the L.A. Crack epidemic and Freeway Ricky Ross, the most notorious figure in that whole era, this was just a huge embarrassment because the media completely screwed that job up. And it was stuff that the CIA all along was denying. And as a result of Gary's work, despite the fact that he paid the ultimate price for it, the CIA was forced to finally acknowledge for the first time ever that it had an official policy of not informing the Justice Department about criminal activities by Central American anti-communists that it was working with, and that it basically buried up, you know, 15-plus years worth of drug smuggling by its assets.
And Mickey, if I could just jump in.
Yes, David Talbot.
I think the whole shameful episode of Gary Webb, this brave investigative journalist who was basically crushed by his own colleagues at the behest, I believe, of the CIA, and Nick Scow tells the story so compellingly in his book, Kill the Messenger, which was made into a movie which I think every American should see. I think it's one of the best movies ever made about journalism, starring Jeremy Renner as Gary Webb. And guess what? The movie was not really widely seen. It kind of disappeared. Nick could go into some of the reasons why. But it seems like the few films that do come out that are critical of the national security establishment just don't get the kind of marketing push that films like Zero Dark Thirty do. But this is why, when you see what the LA Times did, the Washington Post did, the New York Times did to Gary Webb, a colleague who had more guts than any of their reporters to explore the story, and as Nick said, out of professional jealousy, and I think out of sort of obedience to the CIA. They rely on the CIA, these people, for the leaks, the sources, the information that really builds their careers. So these people form a kind of unholy partnership, the national security press and the national security agencies. But because of that, that's why we need things like Project Censored and Pacifica Radio and certainly Hot Books, because there are a few outlets where journalists with integrity can continue to tell the truth, but they're few and far between. Democracy Now, of course, and Salon and The Nation and so on. But we really need to, as readers, as citizens, as listeners, support these institutions that are vital, because you see how the media, the corporate media, works hand in hand with power all too often to stifle the truth.
Indeed, David Talbot, and you can learn more at skyhorsepublishing.com. Do you have another source for Hot Books directly?
Well, my Facebook. I'm in there every day talking about our Hot Books, David Talbot and Facebook. So that's a good page, too, to keep up to date.
David Talbot, you talk about corporate media and their sort of unholy alliance, right? That's kind of almost going back to Lincoln Steffens and then 100 years ago in the early muckraking days, talking about the relationships between big business and banks and politicians and inside government. And, of course, our mutual colleague and friend Peter Dale Scott has long written about this. And Nick Scow, you have Peter Dale Scott mentioned in the book here. And he really hits on the line here. And of course, one of his recent books, The American Deep State, Peter Dale Scott talks about the subtlety that goes on here. And he says the CIA nowadays doesn't really have to buy journalists. Journalists step into line voluntarily to be eligible for promotion, have good relations inside the government, and they are selected for promotion based on their willingness to accept government lies. Nick Scow.
That's a through line in the book that I traced. You know, Gary Webb obviously is the most egregious example of this, but there's so many others. I think a really interesting anecdote from the book involves Bob Perry, who broke some of the first Iran-Contra stories. And again, like Webb, was severely attacked. Perry was effectively told at the Associated Press, you can't do this kind of reporting anymore. He ended up quitting his job at the Associated Press, going over to Newsweek, only to realize he had jumped from the frying pan straight into the fire and was even more vulnerable and was completely taken off the Iran-Contra beat. In fact, Newsweek refused to even cover the Iran-Contra hearings. They just didn't consider it news. And of course, on the board of directors of these papers are people that, you know, are very chummy with the elite of Washington, D.C. political circles and the intelligence community as well. These are people that have the same worldview, the same political ideology, and there's no place for aggressive, independent investigative reporting in their worldview.
And Nick Scow, you mentioned perception management. We have a chapter forthcoming, a couple chapters actually, in our 40th anniversary book coming out this fall, Project Censored 2017, one on CIA media and the mighty Wurlitzer, but the other by Peter Phillips is about public relations firms worldwide and the three major ones, WPP, one of them, also Hill & Knowlton. And these PR organizations, Hill & Knowlton includes the CIA as one of their clients.
What you see with perception management in the 1980s was effectively the beginning of a process of reconquering control over the press through different means. I mean, in today's climate, you just have so much more of a nefarious relationship between intelligence agencies and the newspapers and television networks that provide the news that it's impossible to actually know where these stories come from. Another aspect of perception management that's now very mainstream is just crafting stories for public consumption. So you have newspapers that are printing stories that are specifically targeted at different demographics to try to make people support political objectives that are not in the interests of our democracy.
No, indeed. And David Talbot, let's go back to you on just that general theme of perception management. I believe it's a fair characterization to say that what you're doing at Hot Books is really a counter-narrative to this. It's to really tip the balance or gain some type of balance in the world of perception management that tries to, with really great traditional muckraking kind of journalism and reporting, to try to tell the people, as George Selde said, what's actually going on in the corridors of power in our society.
That's right, Mickey. And let me just quickly run down some. Dee Watkins, a young African-American writer out of Baltimore, who wrote about his incredible upbringing, clawing his way up through the drug trade and finally through John Hopkins and become a terrific mentor now and writer. Dee Watkins, his book is called The Beast Side, which is what they call the East Side of Baltimore, Living and Dying While Black in America. We had an amazing book by a military whistleblower, Joe Hickman, a brave guy who ran a security unit at Guantanamo and was a whistleblower there for an earlier book. And he wrote a book called The Burn Pits, which I think is emerging as the Agent Orange scandal of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you have thousands of GIs coming home from those wars, having been exposed to these open-air burn pits where they literally torched everything, all the garbage that is accumulated by war, including old WMD, including tires and medical waste and all sorts of things. And we feel, he makes a case, that Beau Biden, the vice president's son, who was exposed to some of these terrible contaminants while he was serving in Iraq, might have well have been one of the victims of the burn pits. They're terrible clusters of cancer and respiratory disease as a result of this pollution that the soldiers there were forced to breathe 24/7. We have another book you mentioned by philosophy professor in San Francisco at the University of San Francisco, Rebecca Gordon, called American Nuremberg. It's a very reasoned and well thought out case for why dozens of American officials, civilian and military, should be held accountable, just like Nuremberg trials after World War II, for war crimes as a result of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, from Presidents Obama and Bush on down. It's a very provocative book. We had a book that was a companion book to The Hunting Ground, the explosive documentary about the rape crisis on campus, and of course Nick Gow's book and the book we're going to be talking about later about the heart of the Trump campaign. Who are these people who are supporting Trump, who feel desperate that they have to do that? So these are books that are, I think, essential to provoke the kind of debates that we need about America these days. And guess what? They're not getting reviewed by the New York Times or the Washington Post. It's very difficult to get our authors on MSNBC or CNN and all of that. Nick, as you can tell, is an incredibly articulate and interesting reporter with a lot of information that is vital for people to hear. And thank God, as I said, for radio shows like your own and Pacifica Radio and other stations. But this is really a culture war. We're in the trenches. And while Bill O'Reilly and his books and those kind of right-wing books go immediately to the bestseller list because of the huge right-wing media juggernaut that they have at their disposal.
A whole slew of them just recently.
Yeah, there are four on the bestseller. The top four books on the bestseller list now are all far-right books. So, you know, the progressives really have to build their own kind of amplification system, their own megaphone system to spread the word about films, books, art exhibits that really are trying to tell the truth. And it's up to all of us to do that.
Indeed. And Nick Scow, I want to conclude this segment with you. And I want to say that I think this book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood, is really essential reading. I think if people really want to start to understand the degree to which information is managed and controlled in various outlets, this is a fantastic primer, and it's a quick read as well. Again, I can't help but draw connections to the chapter we'll have in Censored 2017 on the mighty Wurlitzer. But this is such very important work, Nick Scow. It's an honor to have you on the program. You end the book by talking about a few different examples post 9/11. You're talking about Mark Mazzetti in particular, one of the reporters. And you kind of highlight how the CIA manipulates sort of media and journalists even to pit them against each other and to scoop things. You have a quote from John Lindsay over at McClatchy Papers. Could you talk a little bit about some of that, again, more subtle scooping and how that's working to manipulate public opinion?
A very rare thing that Spooked is able to do is to actually get people that are still doing national security reporting to talk about the kind of dirty details of it and how the CIA tries to play them off each other and all the risks that are involved in trying to actually get to the truth. And so Mark Mazzetti, for example, he told me flat out that on any particular story he's working on, he feels like maybe he's lucky if he knows about 20% of the facts. The CIA is not there to do anything other than to try to keep him from being able to do his job. And to the extent that, for example, he was trying to report on drone strikes, he was always under the pressure of not being able to get any real information from the CIA. And, of course, he and many other people had been covering the drone campaigns and knew, for example, the guy who was in charge of it, a person named Michael D'Andrea, for example, who was a character in Zero Dark Thirty. Everybody knew this guy who was a strange dude. And so there were even articles that the Washington Post would put out just talking about
this mysterious Muslim convert that ran the drone campaign. But, I mean, this guy had a much darker history. He was involved with the torture program. He had been involved with losing track of the 9/11 hijackers. And basically, all these guys are part of this club where they're able to get certain stories out there. But in order to do their job, they have to hold back. And they also have editors that are always kind of putting the brakes on their reporting. So they never actually exposed this guy. They never really told the full story of who he was or how dangerous this guy was, who was in such a powerful position at the CIA, until after the CIA basically fired him for botching a drone strike that resulted in two Western hostages being killed in a building that we bombed without any idea who was inside it. It just fit this vague criteria, which we use in Pakistan, of being eligible target if we find it suspicious.
Well, Nick Scow, I'm hoping that people pick up your latest book, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. John Curiacao says Nick Scow, Spooked, doesn't just crack open the door on the CIA's iron grip on journalism, television, and films. It blows that door wide open. This book is a public service, and it serves as a warning about CIA control of so many facets of our everyday lives. That's former CIA person John Curiacao, who did prison time for outing Bush's torture program. Nick Scow, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. Thank you so much for joining the Project Censored show today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're joined today for the hour by David Talbot. He is the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, a partnership with Skyhorse. We were just speaking with author Nicholas Scow about Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. On the next segment of the program, we're joined by another Hot Books author, Alexander Zaitchek. His book, The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. We'll continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. For today's program, we're speaking with David Talbot, who is the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, a partnership with Skyhorse that's been releasing a series of investigative journalistic-style muckraking books on very important and key issues. And David Talbot continues with us for this part of the program. We're also joined by Hot Books author Alexander Zaitchek. His book out on Hot Books, which just came out August 16th, is called The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. So we're going to be speaking with Alex about his book and his experience traveling around the country very recently, talking not about Donald Trump so much as talking with the people that the Trump candidacy has seemed to spark or seemed to embolden. But before we talk with Alex, we're going to go back to David Talbot. David Talbot, just for this segment, please again remind our listeners about Hot Books and what you're trying to do with this series.
Hot Books is a new startup, a scrappy new imprint in partnership with Skyhorse Books in New York. And we're trying to put out short books, about 40,000 words each, on the most burning topics in America, whether that's war crimes or Donald Trump or how U.S. intelligence manipulates the news in Hollywood, as we were discussing earlier. These are books that seldom, the topics, get really investigated deeply enough by the corporate media. And Hot Books is trying to put these kind of burning subjects in front of people to have the national debates that this country so urgently needs.
Indeed, and we're joined by author Alexander Zaitchek. Alex grew up around Boston, started writing for zines as a teenager in the early 1990s. Alex has reported from around the world for dozens of newspapers, websites, magazines, and his new book about Trump supporters has come out on Hot Books, and it's titled The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. So, Alexander Zaitchek, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Great to be here.
Alex, tell us about this book. You know, I can't help but see a little Hunter S. Thompson in there and a little more narrative-style journalism, where you went out and traveled around the country for a few months, and you actually wanted to talk to people that were self-proclaimed Trump supporters, and you wanted to kind of find out what was going on behind not just the Trump campaign, but behind this movement of people, sort of what's at least being displayed in the corporate media as a sometimes right-wing populist movement. But talk to us about what propelled you to do this, and let's talk more in detail about how it happened.
Like a lot of people, I was surprised and a little bit confused by Trump's early success in the primary. And I watched with a little bit of alarm, like a lot of people, when it became clear that he was probably going to run away with the nomination. And I wasn't sure what was behind this, so I hit the road to try to find out. The media tried to answer this question. You know, there was no shortage of articles saying, here's all you need to know to explain the Trump phenomenon, meet the Trump voter, meet this person or that person. But none of these pieces made me feel like I'd met anybody. You know, they'd get two lines, they'd get a 10-second soundbite, or there would be some sort of description of them by someone in the pundit class or some beat reporter covering politics from Washington. So I decided to do what people weren't doing, which was actually talk to people in their communities and let them explain themselves and their lives in their own words and try to get at politics, not necessarily directly by asking them about this or that policy platform that Trump may espouse, but more about what it's like to grow up and live and work in their corner of the country. And I tried to focus on corners of the country that weren't used to heavy media attention. I focused on three regions primarily that were symbolically resonant with the Trump campaign: the Rust Belt, Appalachia, and the border. And I tried to find places in those areas where people were and the media wasn't.
Alex Sacek, I'm a big fan of epigraphs, and you've got some great ones here. And you quote Max Brooks from World War Z: the more those elitist eggheads shouted, "The dead are walking," the more most real Americans tuned them out. Was that your experience when you were researching the book?
Yeah, I mean, that was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek epigraph. But yeah, I mean, I think it does get at an important element of this story, and that is this sense of resentment and opposition with regard to the media class and elites generally, anything associated with what we've come to understand as the establishment. And that's true on both sides of this election. I mean, you saw it in the Sanders phenomenon. And if you're a conservative coming out of a more right-leaning place and you're used to a different kind of language and politics, then your anti-establishment vote was probably going to go to Donald Trump. I mean, there was no shortage of candidates that represented kind of same old, either Koch brothers connected corporate Republican lobbying universe. There was plenty of choice on that side, but people obviously want something different. And the more people told them they were insane or stupid for doing so, the more it kind of fueled in to this sense that this was their kind of revenge and that they were going to do what they want and they were going to have a voice outside of what people were telling them to do.
Well, indeed. And you begin the book, Gilded Rage, great title, by the way. And you say, who are these people? And that's a fantastic question, because we've seen a lot of polls, we've seen various studies, we've seen people arguing about, well, what is the Trump phenomenon, and so on and so forth. And even most recently, we've seen people like Michael Moore talking about how it's, you know, again, sort of like the Great American Reality TV show, some election edition, where Trump is almost a built-in foil for the Clinton Foundation. So it's been a pretty wild ride. But I think what struck me about your book is that you really went to parts of the country where people often are ignored or taken for granted in terms of political demographics. But tell us a little bit about, what did you find when you were talking to these people?
Anytime you really talk to someone, I think, that you have a preconceived notion about, you're going to find that these stereotypes and especially caricatures don't survive all that long. And with regard to Trump supporters, we've been given a pretty steady diet of those stereotypes, and some of them are grounded in things that are real enough. I mean, the footage from the rallies, the violence, you should not discount that. I don't discount any of those images, and it's natural that they would build up a mental picture. But what I found out talking to people, getting people away from the sort of heated, confrontational rally environments, was that the picture was more often than not much more complicated than the sort of angry, red-faced, kind of scowling racist Trump voter.
And you interviewed a lot of people. And the thing, again, that I point out about your book is that you have people in their own voice.
Yeah. And what they say in their own voices is often quite surprising. I was not expecting to find the level of self-awareness that I often encountered with regard to Trump and his shortcomings, and also the self-awareness about their own draw, how they're drawn to those shortcomings and some of the things Trump says. They're not only not sold on these things, but they're disappointed in themselves for responding to them. And there's a level of critical thinking, I think, in the average Trump supporter that, well, I won't say the average Trump supporter. I'm not going to speak for 13 million people and create an alternative stereotype. I would just say within that 13 million people, you're going to find a lot of surprises and people who are not as uncritically fanatical.
But can I just jump in? And what Alex has done here is a remarkable job of bringing these people to life. There's these human portraits of people where Alex goes to a bar and drinks with a veteran or hangs out with people at their home and so on. And what you get is a sense of their humanity and their legitimate rage and bitterness. These are people who fought for their country or soldiers who are returning home, who were used up by the military-industrial complex and thrown away. The same with the corporate system, the coal mining industry, and other industries that have just used these people and thrown them away. And the government and corporate America have found no ways to re-educate these people and give them new skills. And so these are the refuse of American society. And it was only a matter of time before someone like a fake populist like Donald Trump, the gilded populist, to use Alex's term, would come along and begin to exploit this. I mean, now his new campaign manager, this guy Steve Bannon out of Breitbart, tries to present himself as this great populist, and he's an ex-Goldman Sachs guy. But he lets Cook, the CEO of Apple, have it for taking jobs overseas and hiding taxes overseas. And people say right on to that. And, you know, Apple, of course, is the great darling of the liberal elite, but they are ripping off the American people, and they're ripping off American workers. And let's say, frankly, look, journalists I know, including myself, are paycheck to paycheck, frankly. We just hang on, you know? I mean, I start these little businesses and all that, and Alec gets his books published, but he's like sleeping on people's couches while he goes across the country interviewing these people. You know, if you're a progressive working journalist and you haven't sold out and you're not working for CNN or working for some big Washington think tank, then you're day-to-day, like a lot of these people. So I think Alec's empathy comes from the fact that he can genuinely feel their pain.
Yeah, Alex Achick, let's bring you back in, author of The Gilded Rage, Wild Ride Through Trump's America. You mentioned earlier that you go through different regions, and you actually began with who are these people. You go through Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, New Mexico, California, and again, reading these narratives, reading these people is again, it's an eye-opening experience. Let's take Wisconsin for an example, since you write about it in the book. Wisconsin has been in the media the last few years because of this kind of right-wing resurgence, right? This governor, there's a lot of conservative and right-wing ideological energy kind of emanating out of places like Wisconsin. And you interviewed folks that say some pretty interesting things that you don't hear a lot about, and that includes veterans, right? I served in Kuwait during Operation Desert Storm. We shouldn't have been there. Same with Iraq in 2003. And then they go and then they'll attach that to something that Trump says where they believe he's correct about some of the things that come out of his mouth.
Yeah, Wisconsin is actually one of the few states that Trump lost by a significant margin. But still, there were a sizable number of people who cast votes for him. And a lot of the people I spoke with at the Trump rallies were vets who were quite embittered about both the wars and also the experience that they've had upon returning, dealing with the VA, which they consider underfunded and dysfunctional.
This is, again, why I urge people to check out The Gilded Rage. You could read these stories. One of the people in this segment says, I believe in a nice minimum wage, maybe $10, but the more you go up, the more you're shooting yourself in the foot. Watch what happens in California. And Billy's making $15 at McDonald's, but G.I. Joe's only making $9. If you join the service right now, you're making $9.25 an hour. He's defending our country wearing a helmet and a gun, but Billy, who never graduated high school, is making $15 flipping a burger. That's a very real perspective for people in that situation.
And that's a recurring motif, references to the military. I encountered that a lot. There were a lot of things I noticed that came up a lot more than I expected. For example, opioid addiction. No matter where I was, people talked about how with the loss of industry and the loss of stable, often unionized deployment, you had drug use they never expected to see, and kinds of drugs at rates that they're just shocking, especially in Pennsylvania and West Virginia. I was in places that were 60-70% of the young people were on pills or smack. It reported on in the States, especially in New England, in places where people maybe didn't expect to see it, but the depth of it and how broad this crisis is was quite surprising to me, and it came up again and again when people were explaining why they were supporting Trump and trying to probe their own sense of desperation. They're like, I'm seeing things in my community that are just heartbreaking to me, and I don't know what's going on. And of course, Trump has no answers for this stuff. He blames Mexican mafia cartels when it's Big Pharma who's basically triggered this crisis, the overabundance of pills and prescriptions. But again, they always bring it back to the economy. I said, well, the jobs came back, good union jobs, although Trump, again, doesn't talk about unions. Tells you how serious he is about this stuff and his industrial policy. But they know somehow it comes back, the good jobs they knew growing up that don't seem to be around anymore.
And they're not coming back, and it's people like Donald Trump that have outsourced a lot of those kinds of jobs. But Alexander Zaychek, there's some irony there, given that people like Trump have outsourced these jobs. And you even referenced Thomas Frank in the beginning of the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I mean, how much did you see of that happening, or how much self-realization that you mentioned earlier?
Sure. It's more than an irony. I mean, it's sad. This guy is able to convince people that he's the answer when, in fact, you know, as David alluded to, he's a phony, clearly. And his interests are I believe, elsewhere. But there's a sense that is at least speaking the language, and they don't know that it's worth rolling the dice, that he, you know, says he's going to be some kind of traitor to his class, and he's going to think about the little guy and try to get these companies back, whether he has to personally browbeat every CEO in the country. I mean, it's absurd. But if you got no other hopes, if it's that or Paul Ryan, maybe this is worth a shot. So goes the thinking. And that's what I heard again and again. So there is a self-realization that he could be a phony and a fraud. And they know that he's a rich guy who makes his ties in China. Like, a lot of them do know that. But they figure, you know, FDR grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth, too. And look what happened. I mean, they didn't usually allude to FDR, but that's the same kind of hope.
So we're speaking with Alexander Zaychek. He is author of The Gilded Rage, Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. We're also joined by David Talbot. He is the founder and editorial director of Hot Books, and this is one of the hot books that David Talbot has published. When we come back, we'll talk more with Alexander Zaychek about The Gilded Rage. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio. This is the Project Censored Show, and I'm Mickey Huff. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's show, we're looking at the Hot Books series that David Talbot is behind in partnership with Skyhorse. David Talbot has put a lot of effort into this new series, Hot Books, and we were speaking earlier in the program with Nick Scow on his book, Spooked, How the CIA Manipulates the Media and Hoodwinks Hollywood. We are now joined by Alexander Zaychek. He is author of The Gilded Rage, that looks at the Trump supporters in the United States by going and actually milling around and talking with them and spending a lot of time with them, several months in various regions of the U.S. Before the break, we were talking a bit about Trump, the candidate, or Trump, the person himself. And you write, Alex Zaychek, in your book, like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly, Trump entered the race having completed a dangerous experimental mutation from gossip page guppy and playboy developer to a new breed of right-wing populist. Equal parts Howard Stern and Michael Savage, Tony Robbins and Father Coughlin, Kim Kardashian and Benito Mussolini. Again, this is the kind of writing that really drew into the book and the style of the presentation. And you write, the pundits and pollsters assured us the experiment would fail, that this 200-pound insect man bioengineered by Joe McCarthy's old lawyer would be dead within weeks. Well, where are we, Alex Zaychek? That didn't happen.
No, he ran away with the nomination, and it's looking less and less likely that he's going to be our next president. But I think the lesson of the primary season still stands, and I don't think the Republican Party is going to resemble itself pre-Trump anytime soon. So where are we? I think we're sort of in a situation where we need to figure out a way to speak with Trump voters. And when I say we, I mean anyone interested in broader and deeper progressive movement that includes everyone, including poor uneducated whites, who we may want to write off as racists because it's a little bit easier, frankly, than engaging with the divides that are there and not always easy to overcome. But it has to be done. Otherwise, what we're going to see is more ethno-nationalism feeding off of anger, despair, and more Donald Trumps, probably better polished, smarter Donald Trumps who actually want things besides their ego to be fed and stroked. And those are the ones we really need to worry about coming down the pipe in the coming years.
I just want to reiterate what Alex said, which is, I think is really important for all your listeners to grapple with, which is, yeah, okay, Donald Trump may be flaming out here, and maybe we can breathe a sigh of relief about that, but not really, because what he exposed to America was this huge mass of people who are deeply disgruntled, who are deeply desperate, and he may leave the political scene, but look, Steve Bannon and his Breitbart organization, another weird ex-Goldman Sachs populist who has just been named CEO of the Trump campaign, you know, could very well represent the future of the Republican Party. The so-called alt-right is now taking over the Republican Party. It's a dangerous sort of, I think, mix of philosophies and ideologies. You know, it's racist, it's anti-Muslim, it's anti-immigrant, but it's kind of strangely pro-gay in some ways and has some progressive elements as well. It's a weird mixture. It's kind of like fascism 2.0, I think. So we do have to be concerned about the Trump constituency, even if we don't have to be concerned about Trump himself after November.
Alex Zaitchek, perhaps your next book is The Gilded Rage, Take Two, going through the Sanders camp, taking a look at what's going on inside of the Democratic Party, which has basically abandoned any kind of, you know, populism in a progressive sense from 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture at the moment.
Well, when you were traveling around and speaking to these people, what kind of impressions were you getting from some of these folks about Democrats, particularly the Clinton-style Democrats?
Certainly nothing positive about Hillary Clinton or the corporatist Democratic Party. It was basically among Trump supporters grouped in with the sort of corporatist Republican Party. They were pretty sharp-eyed on that. As for the Sanders insurgency, there was a lot of sympathy with big aspects of it, particularly the criticism of Wall Street. You know, I met a lot of Trump supporters who were open to the idea of some sort of universal health care, even, you know, free or subsidized education. But there are some very deep cultural cleavages in this country that stop people from being able to support a self-declared socialist. These are people who grew up in the Cold War, who listened to the talk radio for decades, and they've been pounded with this idea that there's no such thing as free. Free, it doesn't mean free, and they've not just gotten it from Rush Limbaugh, they've gotten it from their fathers and their grandfathers. So the challenge is to communicate a Sanders-like agenda without the ethno-nationalist impulses and connotations of a Trump campaign while somehow addressing these messaging hurdles. It's not going to happen overnight, but there has to be a way to do it. And that's one of the things I kept finding myself thinking about in these conversations, because there was often a surprising amount of common ground, but they just couldn't get around certain things, which sometimes were just a matter of language.
That's a pretty interesting point. And I do want to go back to the so-called Rust Belt. I had mentioned one of the longstanding congressmen there who died not too long ago, but actually was jailed for corruption. That would be Jim Trafficant. And I did bring him up because Donald Trump was just recently in Ohio, spoke at Youngstown State University. And Youngstown is kind of the poster child for Rust Belt depression and, you know, what happened to Youngstown when the steel mills closed. And you get a lot of the same kind of talk coming out of West Virginia and people about coal mines and these kind of things. And it's interesting that there's a history there of people that were union, so they were affiliated with the Democratic Party. But again, on many social issues, they were actually incredibly conservative. So that's something that you saw on the road as well.
Yeah, there was a lot of conservative Democrats in Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, who were voting Trump, and some movement in the other direction as well. But I was more interested in those who were moving over to Trump. And the sense that the Democrats are anti-coal, which of course is related to anti-steel, steel, coke, and coal are all very much related in that region, is something that they can't really get past. And, you know, if that's your economy and that's your livelihood and that's been your family's livelihood for as long as you can remember, maybe you shouldn't get past it until the Democrats come up with a very serious, extremely well-funded jobs and retraining program for the region. And Democrats have made noises in that direction, but I think they need to make a lot more effort in that area.
Well, Alex Zaitchek, among the Trump supporters that you encountered, could you give us some kind of maybe an overview or an assessment of what did some of these people have to say about women's issues or feminist issues vis-a-vis the Trump campaign?
Nobody seemed terribly concerned about the heavy odor of sexism, let us say, that hangs around the Trump campaign. That I'm not going to try to sugarcoat at all. I mean, it's just shot through and through, and it's a different world. that these people, and including the women of the Trump campaign, I spoke with them, and they're like, just kind of laughed this stuff off. And they didn't try to deny it necessarily. I would say the other big ism that everyone wants to know about, racism, is something that was much more a sensitive issue. And when it was brought up, they frequently became angry. In their mind, the whole PC thing, the whole hurling of the racist epithet is just a way of disqualifying them and their whole culture and everything about them. And they think it's unfair. And very frequently, after getting to know some of these people, I can tell you it is unfair. The people who were voting for Donald Trump were not, in every case, racist by any means. Does that mean that there's no racism in the Trump phenomenon? Absolutely not. It's sort of marbleized. It's streaked through, but the idea that you can quantify it or say it measures this much and therefore, you know, draw conclusions that are neat and packageable, I don't know. It's a tough one. But I do not think that it's the primary driver. I mean, I was open to that conclusion when I started my research, but I have to abide by my findings, and I really don't think this is primarily a white ethno-nationalist movement. I think that the economic anxieties are much more important than the racial hang-ups and anxieties that are also co-present and, as I said, streaked through. I mean, I just have talked to too many people over too many hours and gotten people to have their guard down too much to think that's all that's going on here. And again, I didn't go to the Deep South. I did stick to six states in the regions I mentioned. So I'm not claiming, again, to know 13 million souls. But what I found does not line up with this sort of easy media stereotype of a racist vanguard. And that's all this is. I think a lot of people want to believe that because, quite frankly, it lets everyone off the hook. Just a bunch of racist yahoos. Close the book.
Alexander Zaitchek, author of The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. You can learn more at zaitchik.com. That's ZAITCHIK.com. And we've also been joined for the hour by David Talbot. He is founder and editorial director of Hot Books in partnership with Skyhorse. You can learn more about Skyhorse at skyhorsepublishing.com. And David Talbot said earlier you could find him on Facebook and you'll see him promoting many of the Hot Books. And we certainly intend to have more Hot Books authors on the Project Censored show. So, Alexander Zaitchek, thank you for your latest work and thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
David Talbot, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mickey. It's been a pleasure.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored show today. I'm Mickey Huff, your host. Peter Phillips will rejoin us next week. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, and Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on 35 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.